What's up, everybody? Episode 3 of Opening the Door. And the focus of this episode is going to be on what effect the Parkland shooter's penalty phase trial has already had on the state of Florida. And because it got such national exposure, is it going to affect other states? So as always, I got Pete Sardis here with me to talk through the death penalty in our state, in other states, and this Nicholas Cruz penalty trial, penalty phase trial that happened recently in our state. So where are we going to start, Pete?
Well, I guess we should probably start with what the state of the law was and kind of how we got to where we are. So everybody, I'm sure, remembers the Parkland shooter, Nicholas Cruz. He pleads guilty to murder, first-degree murder of 17 people. He pleads guilty to the attempted murder of an additional 17 people. And the prosecutors had done a notice for a death penalty. And in order for Florida, until recently, to be able to impose a death penalty, a jury has to find unanimously that one, at least one of the aggravating factors in the Florida statute were met, and that unanimously the jury agrees that the death penalty should be imposed. That's what the rule was. Parkland shooter's death penalty phase came back 9-3. 9 people for the death penalty, 3 people against. And because of that, it's not unanimous. The Parkland shooter, Nicholas Cruz's sentence is life without the possibility of parole. Governor DeSantis took this pretty personally, I think.
It wasn't just him.
I think a lot of people, yeah. But he is the governor of the state of Florida. And he actually went publicly and said that he thought it was an outrage, basically. So what does he do? He kind of asks... All right.
Before we get there. So let's just talk about the reaction to the verdict. We heard from the jurors. We heard from the family members. We saw the prosecutors. We saw the judge. Everybody, it seemed, was outraged by this verdict and the life sentence versus death, and asking questions like, why have the death penalty if you're not going to have it in place for a case like this? Let's also think and talk about how the state of Florida right now is Republican run. They have all of the power. They are pushing through legislation, bills, laws that are in line with their party. And we've seen it in a bunch of different arenas. And when it comes to the death penalty, usually the right-leaning politicians are more in favor of it. And again, that'll come into play when we talk about what Governor DeSantis is doing right now and kind of where the state is going and why it's going there. There may be people on both sides of the aisle that agree or disagree with this move. So I think it's really important to think that it was not just DeSantis that was outraged, but a lot of people, and especially a lot of people specifically in Florida. So when we look at that, in reaction to that, and with that kind of purview, now let's get into what did DeSantis do? What's going to happen now in our state?
So what winds up happening is the legislature proposed a bill, and the bill is absolutely backed and, frankly, in my opinion, sponsored by Governor DeSantis. And that bill is supposed to reduce the unanimous requirement of the death penalty phase down to an 8-4 split. So if 8 people vote for the death penalty, even if 4 people say, no, we shouldn't do the death penalty, the court then can impose the death penalty.
Which would be a 2/3 majority, basically.
Yeah.
So 2/3 of the people would have to vote. So if 7 people voted for death, 5 didn't, then it would still be a life sentence.
Correct.
Even though it was a majority. It's not a majority rule. It's a supermajority. It's a 2/3 vote. Now, what's interesting about that is, I believe the Nicholas Cruz case came down to a 9-3 vote.
That's correct.
It started out as one holdout, but because we heard from the other jurors, we heard that at the end of the day, 3 people ended up deciding to not vote for death. 9 voted for it. So that case would fit in to this new system, and he would have ended up getting the death penalty.
By one vote. So it was 9-3, and now it requires 10. I'm sorry, eight.
Right. Before.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. And I think that's interesting and probably not, not a coincidence. So when we're looking at 8-4, there's a couple different ways and a couple different, you know, areas I want to hit on in this, but let's first talk about other states.
Okay.
When we talk about 8-4, is that unprecedented? Are there other states that have 8-4? Are there other states that have non-unanimity?
Let me give you the breakdown from 50 states down. Of the 50 United States, only 27 states have a death penalty. Of the 27 states that have a death penalty, only three others, not including Florida, have a non-unanimous statute. Two of them are Missouri and Indiana. Those two states say that if the death penalty phase is not unanimous at the jury, the judge has to make the ultimate decision to determine whether any aggravating factors have been met beyond a reasonable doubt. Alabama was the only non-unanimous state that allows the jury to make a decision other than Florida. And Alabama, and don't take this the wrong way, Alabama, but Alabama's not exactly had the history of like the biggest human rights protectors, all right? Alabama statute is 10-2. So we are less than the requirements of Alabama when it comes to determining whether somebody should be put to death for a murder conviction.
Okay, so we would potentially be the most liberal state with this.
Yeah, it depends how you look at it. Either
that's a good.
We're killing people willy nilly right now. Yeah, exactly. So you have more likely to be executed in Florida than any other state, and that's important because you are in fact more likely to be executed in Florida than any other state. There have been 30 death penalties that have been overturned. Of those 30 death penalties, a lot of them were 9-3.
In
that
Florida
have been overturned in Florida specifically.
Right. So it used to be the law in Florida was more similar to this.
Correct. It's actually kind of gone back to the way it was. If you kind of look back, and now I'm really kind of going back, if you look like post-Civil War up to the beginning of the 20th century, it was always, almost a preponderance standard. As long as more people voted for death than not, we were good to go, which is why we were executing people like crazy. It didn't really change until the 1980s, 1970s, 1980s. That's when it really started to change, and then it became unanimous. And it's been unanimous until now.
So, and that's wild to me to think about how we're going to go back to that when we talk about wrongful convictions and how important it is that we don't have that happen, especially with death. And now we're going back to where most of the wrongful convictions, I mean, very rarely is a unanimous decision overturned.
Yes, true.
But, so let's talk about this in a couple different ways. First question I have, what do you think? What do you think the rule should be?
I think it should be unanimous. And if it's not going to be unanimous, I think the court has to play a major role in the decision-making. And again, understand that we can sit here and talk theoretically about someone that is guilty and is guilty of murder, is, you know, first degree, it was atrocious, all of that stuff. But that's not real life. Real life is a balancing act. And you're talking about taking someone's life. And by taking someone's life, that's about as permanent as it gets. So in my opinion, I'm a believer of safeguards. So having a unanimous death penalty phase, in my opinion, makes sense because life without parole is not a easy sentence.
Some people think it's worse than death.
I think it's worse. Yeah. I would rather just like, all right, light me up. Let's be done. Turn on Sparky. As opposed to sitting for the rest of my life, you know, in a box.
So I agree with you 100%. I think that if we're going to have the death penalty, it should be unanimous. And if you can't convince every single person there that you picked as a fair and impartial jury, then it ain't meant to be. Mm-hmm. We do get things wrong once in a while, right? I think that's something we have to admit, even as lawyers that believe in the system and believe in the jury system. Right. And we also do have, like you said, an additional safeguard, and judges do play a part in Florida right now. Judges can make the determination that even after a jury says death, the judge can say no, life. Now, they can't do the inverse. They can't say, like in Parkland, which I think may have happened, that if the jury says life, the judge can't step in and say, no, we're giving this person the death penalty. So that's an additional safeguard to make sure, as my dad always says, death is different. And that's an additional safeguard that we have in place to make sure that we don't have just willy-nilly people getting the death penalty.
Yeah.
Now
to be fair, with the new law that in fact has passed the legislature, we're just waiting for the governor to sign it. Those safeguards are still in place. So in Florida, if it's an 8-4 split, the judge may impose death. If it's less than 8-4, the judge must impose life without the possibility of parole.
Right. But we don't have all the safeguards because we've lost the unanimous. We've lost the other four jurors as a safeguard.
Clearly.
So I think that's potentially problematic. So one of the responses to people like us who may still want unanimity is, and I can't remember if DeSantis said this or somebody else, that we do have the safeguard that all of these jurors unanimously believe that this criminal defendant committed this crime. So as far as wrongful convictions or convictions being overturned, those are still going to be unanimous convictions because right. The conviction rate is not going to change to 8-4. That still has to be unanimous. So if they get the conviction wrong, it was still a unanimous conviction that they got wrong.
Right. And to take it one step further, the jury still has to make a determination if one of the aggravating factors necessary to impose death has been met beyond the reasonable doubt by the state, and that still has to be unanimous.
Exactly. And that, to me, again, is still at least some safeguard in place, but I just don't understand. I mean, when you're there, when a jury's there, and we can talk about this, when they're there for a murder case or something like this, and they know the death penalty phase is coming later, they know that. They know that convicting this person, there's going to be a death penalty phase of the trial as well. They talk about that a ton in jury selection. So in making that decision of guilt, they know that the next question is coming. So, you know, maybe there's a way to kind of read that into the psychology that they are making the decision on guilt, knowing death is an option. It may come with just a 2/3 majority. And you probably know in the jury room when you're talking, if they're all like, oh, this guy's the worst, he deserves whatever's coming, you know, some of them want that type of punishment to come when you're discussing the verdict. So if you, you know, really want to get out from under it, that's the time to discuss it. And I think that that's going to maybe come into play. And we may even see some not guilty verdicts on some of these cases because a juror believes so much that they should not get the death penalty. And they know that they're going to be outnumbered 11-1 when they start talking death penalty because everybody else wants heads to roll. But they're sitting there like, I'm not positive he did it. Or if he did do it, maybe it was because of this psychological defect or abuse that he suffered as a minor or something like that. And maybe we're going to see some not guilty verdicts for people that deserve to be in prison for life.
Yeah, because I'll tell you, from my perspective, I think what happened with these jurors is someone got up there and said, this guy is 19 years old with mental illness, with all the issues that he had. And I think somebody got up and said, are we really going to kill this person? I mean, yeah, he should go to prison without a doubt, but we're going to take this person's life based on these facts. And I think that was the fight. Obviously, at what point it was 11-1? 11-1 turned into 9-3. So obviously somebody talked other people into that logic. And if I were on a jury now, based on this new law, I think you're right. I may think this kid's 19 years old. I'm either not going to convict him for murder, or if I know that I still have to determine that the aggravating factors are met, I may say, nope, I can't agree on the aggravating factor. Hasn't been met. But so, now you're asking people though to not follow the law.
Right. Which is nothing. We never want that as lawyers.
Right.
But for all the people that are outraged about that line of thinking about that, he's a younger guy. Now what he did was despicable, but to compare it to something else that's despicable that another young guy did, in a case that you covered in Aiden Fucci, death penalty was never even considered in that case. Why?
He's a minor.
Exactly.
And the rules are, unless you have to be an adult, and in Florida, adult by definition is 18 years or older in order to be eligible for the death penalty.
So exactly. And that's your answer. And so just a few years separate Aiden Fucci and Nicholas Cruz. So based on the law, we draw a line. We have to draw a line somewhere. So the law does not see these two as incredibly different. They do see them incredibly different based on not a huge age difference. We're not talking about a 50-year-old man and a 15-year-old. We're talking about people that are 5, 6, 7 years apart. So I don't think it is that wild for a jury to look at Nicholas Cruz or a juror to look at Nicholas Cruz similarly to the way that lawmakers look at somebody like Aiden Fucci, who also did something unforgivable and horrible and ended a life and ruined the lives of the family members and people around Tristan Bailey. Okay. But to say that this juror who kind of sees them more similarly and thinks that because of his age, because of what he went through, because of abuse, because of whatever, he deserves life instead of death. Well, there are lawmakers that felt that way for people like Aiden Fucci. So it's not that far of a stretch to understand how people do come to these decisions when they're in the jury room deliberating cases like this.
Right. But also remember, now our technology is different. And how many people through the Innocence Project, we've been on those cases. We run the DNA after somebody's been in prison for 25 years and we find out that they are statistically excluded from the possibility of having committed this crime. And those people spent 25 years of their lives behind bars wrongfully. Imagine having that determination or figuring that all out after you've executed someone. And you're putting that on the hands or on the shoulders and in the hands of people that are not lawyers. They're just reading the jury instructions that the judge gives them. And we've been in that situation more than once where they come back and they don't even understand the instructions on the piece of paper, let alone having to do this philosophical discussion and have these, you know, mental gymnastics to get to the point where, what do I need to do in order to protect, to safeguard this person's life if I don't believe that the death penalty should be imposed?
Yeah.
I think that's a lot of motion for people that are not trained in this.
And it doesn't even take into account the mandatory appeals and all the stuff that comes with the death penalty. And we've seen and talked about in other states like Idaho, where they don't even have the proper tools to follow through with the death penalty. And how that's becoming an issue. And we've seen cases like in Florida, I believe, I think it was in Tampa, a case where the guy actually wanted the death penalty because he was older and he said, I'm never even going to get there anyways. And they actually live better than I live. And so there are all those issues that come with the death penalty as well. But I think the point is, it would be, or it is going to be, in my opinion, a little alarming to see a state move the other way in today's culture, in today's society, to move toward making it easier for somebody to get the death penalty while other states are removing the death penalty as inhumane and as cruel and unusual. It's being removed in some states. And then our state's not just keeping the death penalty, but they're making it easier for somebody to get the death penalty. How do you think the response is going to be when most people don't even know when this stuff happens and the outrage happens after it's already done? What do you think the response is going to be in Florida and around the country?
Truth be told, I don't know what's going to happen in Florida, because as of late, I'm seeing people in Florida just excited over the things that I'm like, what are you people talking about? How can you be excited over a topic like this? So I think right now, with political rhetoric being the way it is and social media having such an impact in people's belief system, I think Florida is going to have a bipolar effect. People that are very, very, very pro death penalty and very, very ultra right are going to be super excited, which is why, in my opinion, I think Governor DeSantis did this, because if he's going to run for president, he's got to get that Donald Trump vote, and you got to get those ultra right people. You're also going to have the people in the ultimate left having the exact opposite visceral reaction. Like, how is this even possible that we're going back to what we were doing in the 1850s? Around the country, I think they're going to laugh at us. The Europeans don't have a death penalty at all. Frankly, the majority of the countries in the world don't have a death penalty. Canada doesn't have a death penalty. Of the whatever 50 minus 27 states don't have a death penalty. So I think that you're going to see a lot of lawyers, and it's going to find its way up to the Supreme Court. The problem is, right now, the Supreme Court has a very conservative makeup, but at some point that will probably change. It may not be today, it may not be tomorrow, but at some point it may change, at which point I think you're going to start seeing a lot of this stuff get unraveled again.
Yeah, and I mean, it's rare to see a state or a country in the position where everybody's basically on the same page in all branches of government, and that's basically what Florida has right now, and you're seeing them get a lot done. And it's funny, even people that agree with their politics are disagreeing with some of the things that they're doing. because they are going hard. They are making big swings. And again, a lot of people are thinking that this has to do with DeSantis running for president, which could be a big part of it. But a lot of it is affecting the legal community. They're changing laws. They're changing procedure. They're now changing the death penalty. So these are things that are going to affect the citizens in the state, right? And that's really why I think Florida's response to this is the most interesting, because you know, they're the ones that are going to have to deal with the fallout from all of this.
Right. And think of it on a very, on a much smaller level. The representative, state representative for the district where Parkland is, voted against this law. It was pretty much party line. A couple of Republicans voted against it. A couple of Democrats voted for it. But for the most part, it's a party line question. But when you look at Florida, we're kind of in that mix, 50-50, if not 50-50, 49-51 between what we would consider Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives. So the margins are very tight. And I'm not crazy about what I perceive as the legislature steamrolling a bunch of stuff that they normally could not pass right now, because right now it's the perfect storm. We've got a Republican governor that really wants to go all out. We've got a Republican-controlled Senate and state legislature. All of that is just pushing as much as they can through. I don't know if this is really being well thought out.
So I think what's interesting about that is it's always good to look, whether you agree with DeSantis or Biden or disagree with DeSantis or disagree with Biden, it's always important to remember, like, and it's good because we have the contrasting political parties at this point. When your political party is in control, that's when checks and balances are really important, because the pendulum always is going to swing the other way. And you don't want things to go too far, regardless of what your political affiliations or beliefs are. Sometimes that can come back and really hit you in the face. And I think that we're seeing some of that in our state, and we'll see if there's a big backlash. That's, I guess, what I'm saying is, will there be a backlash to this and some of the other things that are coming down in Florida? And that's what I'm interested to see.
Yeah, I think there is.
Go ahead.
I think there is. I think you're going to see this stuff matriculate into the federal, into the Supreme Court over the course of the next few years. And I think that's when you're going to really see a lot of this discussion happen. And a lot of the, a lot of this very well may be unconstitutional federally at some point.
Right. And I think that we'll see. And a lot, I mean, a lot of the stuff that we're dealing with, the tort reform, that's going to go up as well, and be challenged. Do you think, I guess this is one of the major questions. Do you think this was a direct response from the Parkland shooter case?
I think it was a direct response to a political opportunity because of the Parkland shooter case. Meaning, I don't think Cruz's sentence made this state so pro-death penalty that it was time to make a change. I think it was an opportunity seized by the ultra-right to push something through that has been important to the ultra-right voters that DeSantis has to capture.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think so. I think tort reform was a feather in his cap, and he wanted to make sure he could go for the presidential election to say he brought tort reform to Florida. I'm not really so sure, and we don't really usually get into politics, and I don't want to get into politics, but I'm not so sure it was as much political as it was literally. It felt to me like it felt to me like a direct response to Cruz with the 8-4, with the comments that were made, with the timing of it before he left to run for president, right after the Cruz stuff came down, right after Cruz's judge now is getting disqualified on cases. You know, I think that that is really too coincidental for me. I feel like this was we may never know. This to me felt like a direct response to the Parkland shooter case. And people always wonder, what effect is this case going to have? What precedent is this case going to have? It's a combination of that case, but also all of the eyes on that case, all of YouTube, podcasts, social media, news networks following that case. How many death penalty phase trials have been broadcast like that, where people are actually watching, paying attention, listening to the excruciating details and facts, and then coming down with a win, quote unquote, for the defendant, that he's going to get life instead of death?
Well, hold on. I think every high profile murder case from Ted Bundy, which is also a Florida case, forward has been has had these discussions. The difference, I think, is now the social media reach is so substantially different than it would have been back then that it really brought this to the forefront. And it's very easy for people to have very detailed discussions about this from all over the world and for everybody else to know that it's happening. Does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I mean, that's the point. I think now there's a totally different audience that's watching now. It's a much bigger audience. Mm-hmm. It's a much more diverse
audience.
Clearly. But even they agree that, you know, even people that don't believe in the death penalty or live in states that don't have it or don't want it are like, if you're going to have it, this seems like the case for it. So, and that was really the sentiment across YouTube, across social media, is it is crazy as to how this case and how this outcome happened, especially to the excruciating detail they went into the facts of what happened, even though this was a penalty phase only trial. And that's the really interesting part, is this was not even somebody who claimed that they were innocent. And maybe that worked to his benefit, who the heck knows. But I mean, that's really what's interesting, is how social media, how the way we view these cases is literally changing the world, changing the law, accelerating changes in the law, because we got instantaneous reactions right when this happened from the world on social media. Then we got responses from the jurors. Then we got responses from the family members of the victims. Then we got responses from politicians, all broadcast. Everybody gets in on the conversation. Everybody seems to be on a very similar page. And boom, we have this law change.
Right.
And now I'm interested to see, is this going to happen in other areas?
Because this is frightening from my perspective, because now you're talking about every time something is popular on social media and gets a lot of kickback, there will be a knee-jerk reaction to a law change based on emotion as opposed to a law change based on facts and legal rhetoric amongst educated and, you know, knowledgeable people in a specific topic.
And this is going to create a situation where people call for these immediate law changes in this kind of fashion, where in the past, governing bodies have said it's impossible. We can't do it that fast. It's got to go through the process. You know, how many times do people think juries get it wrong, or that rule is not fair? That law is not fair. Why don't we change this? Why don't we change that? Are we going to change it to unanimous criminal convictions are going to go away? Mm-hmm. That's the stuff that's a little scary, is how quickly this happened to where the general public in our state, our country, around the world, people are going to say, that's wrong. That's not fair. If that's what the law says, let's change the law. And if not, maybe I'll go get on a jury and change it. So, I mean, that's interesting, is clearly Ron DeSantis felt like this jury got it wrong. And I don't know if I should say Ron DeSantis, whoever's behind and everybody involved in changing this law, they feel like this jury got this question wrong. And because they can't change this outcome, they are going to change the rule. And that's interesting when you start moving goalposts. Now, listen, laws change, rules change, things like that happen. But because of how quickly this was, and because of how loud everybody was disagreeing with and thinking they made the wrong decision, that's what's interesting to keep an eye on in the future, is are these high profile cases going to affect our laws, and are they going to affect them immediately?
And from a perspective of a student of history, this is exactly the stuff that we're trying to protect against. This is George Orwell. This is Animal Farm. This is propaganda is making political action in the law very quickly. And that's scary.
And even if you agree with it, right? Because if the roles were reversed and it was the other side and they were doing something you disagreed with and they fast-tracked it and there was no real checks and balances in the situation and they put it through, that's how you got to think about it. Whether you agree or disagree with DeSantis, whether you agree or disagree with this rule change, because like I said, a lot of people support DeSantis or are behind him or whatever politically, but will disagree with this or something else that he's fast-tracking. And you look at it and you start to understand, okay, we need to be careful, regardless of what our politics are, with fast-tracking certain things and not having all the appropriate checks and balances in place, which I think makes this whole discussion really interesting. So if you guys have any comments on it, let us know. If you're watching on YouTube, let us know in the comment section and hit that like button. Make sure you subscribe. If you're listening to it on the podcast, let us know either on Instagram, on Twitter, at Tragos Law, or you can leave us a review with a question in it on whatever podcast platform you listen on. But that's it for this episode. Appreciate everybody watching and listening. to the Opening the Door podcast, where we talk about stuff that's not necessarily coming into courtrooms, but that is going to affect our cases, affect our laws, and especially how everybody talking about this stuff can have an effect, regardless of if it's evidence, regardless of if it's admissible or not, because this stuff can actually make a difference. So Pete, thanks. That's all we got for today. Thanks for watching another episode of The Lawyer You Know. If you enjoyed the episode, please hit the thumbs up and share with your friends who may be interested here on YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe. You can also follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and TikTok at Tragos Law is our handle. And don't forget to listen to The Lawyer You Know podcast, featuring new episodes every week. If you have a case you want to talk to us about, if it's a personal injury case, wrongful death, catastrophic injury, car accident, or slip and fall case, please email us at lawyeryouknow@gmail.com. And of course, all these links I just mentioned are included in the description below on this episode and every episode. So until next time, this is Peter Tragos, The Lawyer You Know.